The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening I want to talk to you about forgiveness. Forgiveness is an interesting topic for us in Dharma because there is a difference between what we understand in the West for forgiveness and more or less the equivalent in Buddhism. We'll see that it's slightly different. But everywhere where Buddhism has gone, in every different country, it has taken characteristics from the culture that it merges with. And so we'll see that this aspect of forgiveness in some ways has also come together with Buddhism creating something that suits our needs and our culture. I always find very interesting to look at the etymology of words. So if we look at forgiveness, we have the prefix for that can mean two things. It can mean away or completely. And then giveness, obviously from giving. So with forgiveness, we can think that we are giving something away completely. And just a simple definition for forgiveness, it's a conscious and deliberate decision to let go of resentments toward another person or ourselves when some damage was done. So if we look at forgiveness in a slightly wider meaning for us, you know, I think for many it's associated with religion. We don't have to look very far and we get to aspects of punishment and guilt associated there with forgiveness. Neither guilt nor punishment are part of Buddhism. Guilt directed to ourselves in Buddhism is not considered fruitful. In guilt-tripping somebody else is definitely considered unskillful. So in Buddhism, we don't talk about punishment or forgiveness, but more about looking at the cause and effect of our behavior. Now, if we plant unskillful seeds, we will suffer. You know, it's just like if A, then B. Very simple. We might say that's karma, but I'd like to keep it even simpler just to say there's a cause and then there's an effect. So it's not coincidental that in Buddhism we don't have in Pali a word for forgiveness. The closest that we have is a word in Pali called kamati. Kamati means patience, capacity to endure, and abstain. Now, it's interesting, Gill mentions, we have in the West such a need for forgiveness because it's so much a part of our culture, that kamati has been often translated as forgiveness. But this is really more because we have the need and not so much because of the precise meaning, as I mentioned to you, since it means patience. capacity to endure and abstain. So how do we relate to wrongdoings in Buddhism? To begin, begin with, we don't frame it in the dualistic ways we do in the Western world of a perpetrator and a victim. Because this solidifies this dualistic view of the bad one and the weak one, or the helpless one. We are asked in this practice to switch the focus from the outside person who was the wrongdoer to ourselves and investigate how do we relate to the feelings that are coming up from this harm or damage. We are encouraged to take full responsibility for whatever comes up for us, of our emotions. We don't go asking another to absolve us for our wrongdoings. The idea is that if we recognize our faults, that allows us to free ourselves from them. And of course, this is something that we wish, but we want to remember that this happens not because somebody offered us forgiveness, but we did the work. We are presented basically with a four-part approach for dealing with some damage that we ourselves did or somebody did for us. There is the recognizing, communicating, making amends, and establish the intention not to cause harm again. Another aspect that I think is interesting to look at is that because in Buddhism we don't have a god, we are not looking for salvation in an exterior source. Instead, it's within us that we're looking for this forgiveness. So how is it that in the West we have in some way integrated forgiveness into the practice? Most of you, I would imagine, or some of you have already come across some guided meditations where we are guided to forgive ourselves and forgive others. And usually this is done as a preparation for the metta or loving kindness meditation. So we can say that within Buddhism, forgiveness practice is a form of letting go of ill will. No, ill will being the second hindrance. It's a relief for us to be able to let go of this burden, right? Resentment is a burden that we carry. And so we're able to release this burden by letting go. It was interesting for me to look at another word of forgiveness, pardon, and then look at the etymology of that word, because I found that that word really comes rather closely to the values in Dharma. So pardon comes from the Latin perdonare, donare, to give freely, and per means to persevere. You persevere despite the obstacles presented to you. You continue giving despite the obstacles. So this point of not holding on to grudges and to continue to give I find very inspiring. And we continue to give because we recognize our shared humanity and the reality that we are all flawed. You know, even if we don't mean to, we hurt other people. So we continue giving ourselves and others what is needed to live fully with an open heart, despite of the damage caused to us by others or the damage we have caused ourselves. José Raza says, if love is giving, forgiving is to continue loving. This quote comes from the Chilean etymological dictionary, and he comes up with this lovely quote from the meaning of pardon, of the word pardon or perdonar. I quote again, if love is giving, forgiving is to continue loving. So as I said before, a resentment, we can visualize it like a heavy load. We all, I'm sure, have met people who have carried resentment for years or decades, and they're not happy people. You know, we know that people who hold on to grudges and resentment tend to go or lean towards anger, towards depression, tend to be rigid. And a lot of times that our health is also influenced when we hold grudges for a long, long time. So in this practice, we are made aware of holding resentments, and we learn that it's not only unnecessary to hold resentments, but it's also not fruitful at all. So we're encouraged, as soon as we are able, to let go of resentments, and this is important, regardless if the person deserves it or not. We do that because we recognize that by doing so, we are helping ourselves. And by forgiving or letting go of our resentment, it doesn't mean that we are condoning what the damage that was done to us, whatever action. The action might be horrible, and we don't approve at all. But that's separate from being able to forgive, to pardon. So I hope that we keep that distinction clear. And the other really important aspect of forgiving or forgiveness is the timing. We will explore a little bit about what it takes to practice wise forgiveness. And timing is an essential one. Forgiving is a process, and we have to allow ourselves to go through the process until we are ready. It's like an apple maturing in the tree. It'll mature when it's time. And so we wait until we're truly able to express forgiveness in a genuine way. So looking at specifically the from the side of when we harm somebody else or the property of somebody else. So when I was thinking of investigating and coming up with an example and the different facets that we go through when we're trying to make amends, I remembered an example, not a big one, mind you, it's a minor one, but it's a good one to investigate. And we also want to keep in mind that we want to practice the skillful, wise forgiving in little things for ourselves in our daily lives, so that when the big one, the difficult ones come, we're familiar with the whole process, this four-part process. So here goes my little, a bit insignificant, example. A few months ago, I'm arriving at the gym, pull into the parking lot. I have to make a pretty sharp left, and on top of it, two cars to get into to do a parallel parking. The two cars have parked so that they're a little bit on the white line. Way too narrow. I was going slow, but obviously not slow enough to not scratch the car to my left. So the moment that this happened, the typical situation, the typical thing, let's look at the first phase, the recognizing. So some aspects of the recognizing, the phase number one, recognizing, the negating it. No, I'm sure it was just a minor scratch. I barely heard it. But I just sat there and I said, okay, let's just sit here and breathe. Then very typical comes the anger, right away. And usually the anger that we are projecting outward. Oh, why did those people park on the white line? They made the space too narrow. I wouldn't have hit the car if they hadn't, blah, blah. The anger expressed outward. Then comes the anger expressed inward. Oh, why didn't I pay more attention? I should have pulled in a little bit slower. The turn was really tight, etc. And then comes the negotiation part. Well, I'm promising myself, I was about to get out of the car to take a look, if one could really see this scratch. And before that, I say, well, oh, that please, that the scratch doesn't show, and I'm really going to try hard to be more careful in the future. I get out, the scratch shows. Little, mind you, but there it was. Clearly, there it was. Then comes the depression. Oh, bummer. My car insurance is going to go up, and I've had all these expenses. Oh, da-da-da-da. Okay. So that's about it as far as what comes up typical in the mind in the first phase of recognizing. Then comes the part of the communicate, the responsibility, right? You've got to communicate the other person. You did some harm. So here, of course, has the part of acceptance comes, accepting that you did some harm. So I sat there and I said, okay, the right thing to do is I write a note and I put my name and I put my phone number and that's, you know. So I did that. And the third one is make amends. So after I put the note and I went to pedal with all my might, the stationary bicycle, to get my energy out, I had to make amends and call my car insurance and make, you know, and this person got in touch with me and blah, blah, blah. So we took care of it. And then the fourth one, the intention of not harming in the future again. So, of course, I set that intention. But I think what was very wonderful, even in this small example, was that I realized how the Dharma just, no matter what goes in through our mind quickly, immediately this mental discipline or commitment we already have with ethics and the Dharma, there was just no doubt in my mind that that's what needed to be done. And so You know, we can say that in those moments we give the gift to the other person to continue believing in the goodness in humanity. And that's not a minor gift. We also want to think about in those moments that our peace of mind doesn't have a price. That we can come to meditation all we want, but if our ethical behavior is not quite there, we're not going to have peaceful meditations. So with the practice of meditation comes, of course, the extending it to an ethical behavior in our daily lives. Now, this was a small example. There can be some very, very difficult situations that we find ourselves that take a lot of time to forgive. Sometimes we have to forgive in solitude because the person who caused harm or the person we caused harm decides to hold on to the grudge for life. And so we can apologize, but it's not going to be a reconciliation. And so then we do the inner work, and then we let go of the guilt so that we can continue living without the burden. So then I want to talk a little bit about ways of apologizing, skillful ways of apologizing, of bringing our mindfulness, our awareness. And to begin with, some time ago I was made aware of something that really, I think it's not common for most of us to see, and it's connected with forms of speech. In English, as well as in Spanish, we say, we ask for forgiveness, right? It's just an expression, ask for forgiveness. And so I thought it was interesting to hear Gil say, think about this. You harm somebody, and on top of it, you ask for something. Forgive me. So, you know, I've become very aware of that. I said, yeah, why? Where did it come from? Why do we ask for forgiveness instead of just say, I'm sorry, and not making the other person owing us something? I'm sure all of you have had, I certainly have, the experience that you apologize and things get worse. You have a tête-à-tête with somebody in relationships, is classic, and you apologize, and it gets worse, and you just kind of sit there and say, huh? What happened? How did it get worse? And so it's very useful to be very mindful in those tricky moments. What is happening? How is it that we are asking for forgiveness that instead of really bringing about a transformation, things get stickier? Here are some of the things that I've been able to observe through the years in myself and other people. We offer an apology followed by a but. And that but has a little blame about the other person, how the behavior of the other person made us commit this mistake. So, for sure, the other person is not going to hear the apology. They are going to hear the judgment. We offer also an apology in a form of a negotiation. We put a condition. We apologize mechanically. In other words, we haven't done our inner work yet. We haven't done our homework. And the other person can tell, right? That we're just going through it in a very mechanical way. This is a tricky one. I noticed in the past that I would tend to do this. We apologize and expect a very specific answer from the other. And if it doesn't come, ill will arises again. And back we are in square one. So we want to remind ourselves that offering an apology is an act of complete generosity. You're offering, so if you're going to offer forgiveness, we offer it completely. We're not expecting anything in response. We express it because we wish to and because we're ready for it. I like to read to you a quote from Tanisaru Bhikkhu. The Buddha praised the honest acceptance of blame as an honorable rather than a shameful act. Not just a means, but the means for progress in spiritual practice. As he told his son, Rahula, the ability to recognize one's mistakes and admit them to others is the essential factor in achieving purity in thought, word, and deed. Or, as the Buddha said in the Dhammapada, people who recognize their own mistakes and change their ways illumine the world like the moon when freed from the cloud. That's lovely, this passage from the Dhammapada. People who recognize their own mistakes and change their ways illuminate the world like the moon when freed from the clouds. And now let's look at when we have been harmed. So it's classic that when we have been harmed, something in us feels like we have to protect our honor, and we look for vengeance. At least our mind definitely goes off full speed thinking of ways how you're going to get even. We see the other as having a debt with us. He owes us an apology. So the feelings of transgression or being wrong, of course, can cause us anger in us. But that anger needs to be acknowledged, not repressed, nor ignored, but also not acted out. Yeah? Alice Miller says, genuine forgiveness does not deny anger, but faces it head on. Genuine forgiveness does not deny anger, but faces it head on. It is difficult for us to see a transgression from somebody else towards us as an opportunity to grow. As painful as they are, we get experience growing pains, but it's definitely an opportunity to grow. It is an opportunity to grow because it points exactly to where we're still stuck, attached to something. Yeah, so it wouldn't make us angry if we weren't attached. And here's an example. Suppose that I am identified with becoming a very powerful member of the Google Maps team at Google. And somebody tells me, oh, you know something? You have a terrible sense of direction. I am going to be very angry when I hear this comment, right? The truth is that I have terrible sense of direction, and somebody tells me, it kind of makes me laugh because it's really true. But you see, that's not where my sticky point is. But we all have our sticky points, right? So, and that's going to be wherever we are identified with something. And so, yes, it's a little painful, but whenever we get that angry response when somebody causes us harm, look at it. There is the practice of taking the focus from the outside towards the inside. What are you doing with that? How are you relating to it? How are you responding to this damage? So how can we receive skillfully an apology? To begin with, we certainly don't demand one, right? Nor do we coerce somebody kind of saying, I won't talk to you until you apologize. It's a classic line, right? And that's not a pure apology. Or similar of what I was saying, thanks for the apology, but, and then we bring up again something they did. Often we can find in a situation when somebody apologizes and we don't quite acknowledge it. Most of the time it's because it makes us a little embarrassed. Something touches in us that makes us a little embarrassed. And so we kind of want to not realize that it's there, so we don't acknowledge it. Skillful receiving of the apology is take it in consciously, hear it, be aware that it was said, look at the person so that the person knows you've heard it. Open to whatever emotions come up in you and take responsibility for them. And then, of course, express your appreciation and gratitude for somebody expressing forgiveness. It's also interesting to look at forgiveness versus reconciliation. It's not the same thing. We might be able to apologize and we get to that, but reconciliation demands one more level of working with it, i.e., the level would be I need to reestablish the trust, the mutual trust. If there are two people involved, I have to be able to trust that person, and he has to be able to trust me again. Then we have reconciliation. And to end, I want to talk about what is pure forgiveness. How does pure forgiveness look like? So, pure, we know that we have come, we are in the presence of pure forgiveness when a transformation in our hearts and the other person's heart has happened. It happens when we've done our inner work. We have purified our anger and resentment instead of blaming, and we have touched the heart of the other. The more we are able to touch the heart of the other, the more we will bring about this transformation. I was looking around for a good example to share of what is pure forgiveness. And I found one that I think is very beautiful. It comes from Markus Zusak's book, The Book Thief. And it describes how a British plane was flying over some villages in Germany, and the British soldier was bombing the villages. The plane has a mechanical problem and falls near a village. I will read you the passage, but keep in mind the narrator in this passage is death. This time I had come for a man of perhaps 24 years of age. It was a beautiful thing in some ways. The plane was still coughing. Smoke was leaking from both its lungs. When it crashed, three deep gashes were made in the earth. Its wings were now sawed off arms. No more flapping, not for this metal bird. Sometimes I arrive too early. I rush, and some people cling longer to life than expected. After a small collection of minutes, the smoke exhausted itself. There was nothing left to give. A boy arrived first, with cluttered breath and what appeared to be a toolbox. With great trepidation, he approached the cockpit and watched the pilot, gauging if he was alive, at which point he still was. From the toolbox, the boy took out, of all things, a teddy bear. He reached in through the torn windshield and placed it on the pilot's chest. The smiling bear sat huddled among the crowded wreckage of the man and the blood. A few minutes later, I took my chance. The time was right. I walked in, loosened his soul, and carried it gently away. All that was left was the body, the dwindling smell of smoke, and the smiling teddy bear. The crowd arrived. As I made my way through, each person stood and played with the quietness of it. It was a small concoction of disjointed hand movements, muffled sentences, and mute, self-conscious turns. When I glanced back at the plane, the pilot's open mouth appeared to be smiling. So, this example of this boy being completely free of resentment, compassionately offering the British soldier this very loving gesture, allowing the British soldier to die with a smile in his face. A powerful transformation takes place in the soldier. The soldier, a man who just minutes before was bombing the German people, he learns in the last seconds of his life that the enemy was capable of being caring, loving, despite the cruelty. So he is invited to see our humanity. There's a little something surprising. I hesitated if I should bring it up. There's a little something surprising that happens at the end of the novel. We find out that this boy is killed in his village by a British plane, very much like the one that had the dying pilot. Could be a little bit disturbing, this ending. And there are many ways that we can interpret this ending. It juxtaposes the personal, loving gesture of the boy and the impersonal, detached cruelty of war. For me, it points to what the Dalai Lama says, that we all have to first find peace within ourselves in order to have peace in the world. And forgiveness is an essential part of that peace. So I would like to think that Cusack, the author, is pointing to the deeper meaning of forgiveness, that of pardon, and its Latin linguistic root of perdonare, which means that means continuing to give. We continue to give and love despite all the cruelty. If love means giving, forgiving means to continue loving. So let's take a couple minutes to sit quietly. So I invite you to consider, how do you relate to forgiveness? Is there any inner work that still needs to happen for you to forgive yourself or forgive others? So you may continue living free of the burden of resentment. So with a few minutes that we have left, we can either have a discussion if there are any comments, questions, or we can also do a very short guided meditation of forgiveness, and you can experience how is it that it dovetails with the metta or loving kindness meditation. So are there any comments, questions? You want to pass the mic?
Well, something that occurred to me was that there's a story that I thought might shed some light on the process. Although I don't know the story awfully well, I was thinking of the case of Angulimala.
Yes.
And the fact that when the Buddha converted him, he certainly didn't guilt trip him in any way. Mm-hmm. He simply changed him to a better person.
Beautiful.
And I seem to remember that at some point in the story that the villagers wanted to punish Angulimala.
That's right.
And did
That's
so.
Right. That's right.
And that Angulimala, I believe, felt that it was justified because, after all, he had harmed them.
Yes.
I don't remember the story well enough to really be...
Well, you remembered a lot, and it's beautiful. Thank you for bringing it up. And for the people who don't know the story, could you just briefly tell who is Angulimala and why...
Well, it's that's the part where I fall apart. If I remember correctly, Angulimala was a young monk who was practicing a different practice, and he was falsely accused by jealous students of having some kind of affair with the other teacher's wife. And for some reason, he was told to collect a mala, of beads made of human fingers. And he was supposed to get 100 of them. And he had achieved, I think, 99, and the Buddha was walking in the woods and was about to be the 100th, but Angulimala could not catch the Buddha no matter how fast he ran. Mm-hmm. The Buddha walked slowly but still stayed in front. And finally, Angulimala cried out, "You there, stop."
Yes.
And the Buddha responded that he should stop.
That's right. I have stopped, but have you?
That's right. But the rest of it all is a little murky. I don't remember. I guess it was just that, as I said, after years of practice, when Angulimala had become a monk, villagers resented his freedom and hurt him. That's all I remember.
Well, you remembered a lot. Thank you. So this is a wonderful, wonderful example, and it's a very well-known story. I mean, here we're dealing with a killer. I mean, he's killing people and then hanging the fingers of everyone he had killed. He was making himself this necklace. So if the Buddha is able to just completely absolve of any guilt to a killer, that's pretty huge, right? It's not a minor thing. So yeah, thank you. It's a great example. Anybody else?
I have a little comment about that.
Oh, great, thank you.
Because that story is often usually given on talks about karma, I think, more than I think, this is my recollection, I mean, that it, you know, in other words, the notion of karma that you could, you know, there's still past consequences of what you did, even though, you know, you could forgive and you could go, it only, it goes so far, but there's no prediction, you know, of the effects of...
That's right.
You know, so I think that was part of the point of that story, that there's a lot to be said for forgiveness, but also you can't expect perfection, you know, that the effects of the past are going to be totally obliterated.
Yep, that's a very, very good point, and that's a very important distinction of you know, our Western minds and in Buddhism. I mean, we just know whatever seeds we're planting, that's what we're going to reap, and regardless if we are pardoned or not, there is the karma, there are the consequences. Good. Well, unless there is a comment, it's basically 9 o'clock. Anybody else? Okay. Well, thank you so much. Have a good evening.